I'm Tena Koutou and welcome to Better Off Red and episode one of that. Woohoo! Yay! I'm kind of excited. I've written a little bit on the blog about what we're up to here, and so what I'm doing is talking to a writer about a book, not a book they've written, but a book that they've read, and I'm just sort of playing out some ideas I've got about how writers read and how what we read affects what we write, and how maybe books are a lot about writing, or maybe not, and the whole sort of endeavour is characterised by experiment, so I'm really grateful to the people that have sort of come on board and done the interviews with me, and I've really enjoyed them so far. I've really enjoyed talking to people about books, and but I'm not sure if that enjoyment will transfer to anyone else enjoying listening to these, but thanks heaps for having a go. I really appreciate it. Episode one is Aidan Rasmussen and I speaking about 2666, Roberto Bolaño's phenomenal, amazing, magnificent. And on the front, there's a quote from the Observer saying, "A novel of stupefying ambition, Bolaño's master statement." This is a book that I love heaps. And, Aidan and I have known each other for a long time. And it's a book that kind of connects us in a lot of ways, which is really great. We sat in his kitchen. And his wife Rebecca and their baby Salva, she's not really a baby, she's a toddler, were upstairs and they were watching My Neighbour Totoro, I think, and having a bit of a play. So I'm really appreciative that they sort of handed over their kitchen for Aidan and I to do this. We both had the same Picador edition. It's a huge book and it was really nice because we kind of were sort of picking it up and, flicking through it and leaning on it and... it's a beautiful edition. 2666 is translated by Natasha Wimmer, unsure. She's an amazing, incredible literary translator. And I'm very grateful for translation when it comes to Bolaño's work because my Spanish is never going to be good enough to read it, I don't think, in the original. So, that's us. Talking about 2666, we talk about the context of it. We talk about sort of the figure of Bolaño, which I think is unavoidable with his work. We talk about plot in the book a little bit. I don't know if there's spoilers. I was listening back over it and I was thinking, would you consider it a spoiler? I'm not sure. So I'm hoping I'm not going to ruin anything for anyone, but it is a huge piece of work. And I'm still not sure what happened in it. So I think the spoilers will be okay. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. The blog is at betterrednz.wordpress.com. Leave a comment if you want. And thanks again for listening. Thank you.
Okay, awesome. Wow, I pushed record. I'm going to do a little introduction later where I say nice things about you. But I was just thinking, like, when I think about this book, 2666 by Roberto Bolaño, the first time I ever came in contact with it, you were waiting for a bus in Aro Valley and you were carrying it.
Yep.
And we talked about it. And that you're the first person I associate with this book, and you kind of continue to be the person I associate with this book. And I think I went away straight away and bought a copy, but I didn't read it for a couple of years because it daunted me. And I read The Ice Rink. Is it Skating Rink?
Skating Rink.
Yeah. And I read Antwerp and I read Savage Detectives. And then I sort of came to this and it blew me away. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about like how you found the book. Like, can you remember how you found the book?
I think, I don't know, I think I went through a phase of being obsessed with Spanish speaking writers, and I don't think I actually, I think it was to do with the fact that I was going to be traveling through South America soon, and I was quite obsessive around scanning the Guardian book pages. I don't do that so much now, and I found a review of The Savage Detectives, and so I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. I haven't heard of this guy before, and so I went down to what used to be Borders on Lambton Quay, and I bought a copy, and I started reading it, and I got really into, this is a bit of a long-winded explanation how I got to 666, but I started reading it, and I got really into the first third, which I think a lot of people do, and then got to that middle section, and I thought, what the hell is this? And then I started really, really liking it, and I obviously did some searches for more work about Roberto Bolaño, and there was, I don't think it had been published yet, 2666, or I think maybe I'd seen it in a bookstore, I can't remember, but it was massive, and it was going to cost me like $50 to buy, and so I found, I think maybe Distant Star, and maybe, I can't remember, I read two other, it was shorter novels or novellas, which I got out of the library, and then at some point it became available at the library, and I got it, and for some reason I remember talking to Brent about it on the bus, because we would catch the same bus down to the bottom of Lambton Quay when we were house sitting in Ara Street, and it's funny, you know, like, I was thinking about it, it's kind of like, this is going to sound quite cheesy, but it's, when you try and describe a book like 2666, it's like trying to define or describe what God is, or to define or describe what sex, how sex feels. It's really hard to describe what this book is and what it can mean to you, you know? Like, I remember, and I still get this feeling of opening it and reading it, and like reading about all these authors, the same feeling I got when reading about all the poets that Bolaño cites and Savage Detectives, and like just feeling like I've walked into something I don't understand or have no concept of, like feeling quite overwhelmed, I think, by the depth and the breadth of this guy's kind of literary knowledge, which I don't even scratch the surface of. But at the same time, I didn't feel like it really mattered that much. There's something about the writing, his writing, all of his writing, but in 2666, which draws you in anyway. And you know, I've read about stuff, and maybe some of these writers that he's citing and stuff may not even be real anyway. Like, yeah, anyway, so that's how I came to 2666. Yeah.
Because that was one of the things I really, like, find intoxicating about it as a book, is I'm always interested in what it means when a writer writes about writers, you know, and writes about writing. And, you know, like, whenever I think of this book, I think of, I mean, that's one of the things with what I'm trying to do here, is that I've asked everyone not to reread the book. So often what we're talking about is the memory of the book and, you know, like the place it takes up in our brains. And for me, I always think of the writer as serial killer because of this book. And I just think, what does that mean? What does that metaphor mean? And, you know, what does it mean to write about writing, like, in the way that it is here? Do you have anything to say about that, or is that a weird...
No, I think, like, from what I've read about Bolaño, he got rejected by quite a lot of people before he got to the point where he's at, and he actually had a very short published life. And I get this sense from his writing, and especially this book, like, and even, I mean, it's often quoted quote about... you know, the one about even the pharmacists today don't, I can't, it's somewhere in the back, are put off by reading the great works, you know. And I think after the first time, and maybe I've read it twice. Oh, the second time I found the book in a bookstore, Casa del Libro, in Passage de Gracia, which is in Barcelona. And I bought it because I wanted to read it again. But I thought that it was, I felt like it was incomplete at the end. But I don't know if that's the if that is the truth. Mm. I like the idea of Bolaño. I don't know if this is really answering your question. Is struggling for that or trying to find that almost unattainable thing, you know, and is willing to, I guess, willing for it to be. Oh, I don't think it's messy, but for this book to. To be great in its messiness, not to tie it off. Like I think he cites The Trial in that quote, and maybe even Moby Dick, which I haven't read. I can't remember your question.
No, but I think that's I mean, it definitely, because I love. I think that is the thing, isn't it? Like I keep talking about it as a book, but it is it's five books, isn't it? And it's. You know, it's that weird conversation that takes place through the five books, and it seems to kind of make itself in the cut, kind of, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, it's almost it kind of seems to make itself in the space between one book and the next, and the space. Yeah, and I think that that's a really good. I found it such a satisfying end, yet not a complete end, which is such a. Strange thing to find.
But I guess okay, I was just thinking about like the idea of where does maybe some of this book is to do with where does the writer fit in society too, you know, like there's the reportage in the part about the crimes there in that first chapter, there's the critics and then you got I guess the sadness and the disappointment of the part about Amalfitano, is it? And then you've got Hans Reiter at the end of it, who possibly is Arcimboldi, I don't know, you know, like you've got all that stuff, and I don't know, you know, like he wrote like he knew, you know, he knew he was dying.
Yeah.
So I guess he wrote like his life depended on it, and I know that's kind of like a cliched thing, but I like the idea of that. That writing like your life depends on it, but then I don't know. I think he's playing so many tricks on us in this book, and that maybe your life doesn't depend on writing too, I don't know. I think it circles back on itself. It's a monstrous book full of monsters, you know. And I think the violence of the book is hinted at when within the book hinted at when the three critics beat up the taxi driver, you know. Yeah. And I haven't really seen too many comments about that, or maybe there are in reviews or interviews about the book or stories about the book. But I think there's this kind of explicit and implicit violence within the book, and I don't know, where are the heroes? Who are the heroes? And and if there are heroes, what heroic acts are it kind of feels like, even though there may be heroes in the book and then possibly heroes in life, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter because, I mean, I'm thinking like in pessimistic, like a cynical thing here, because your best efforts at being a hero don't pay off. Because they all get killed off, I think, in the book.
Yep.
You know, like the detective, who was one of my favourite characters. I don't know about the fortune teller. I think, does she survive? I don't know.
I can't remember.
Yeah,
and I think, you see, that's another thing I felt was so interesting about it, is that, I don't know how to explain it, but I just feel like, capitalism is another one of the monsters in here, you know, like, and I just think, you know, the factories and the, you know, it's, and that wonderful, I just keep hearing that line over and over that's in here about how it's working women, that are being killed.
And I was thinking, maybe they're the heroes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, they're the heroes in the book who we're bearing witness to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think that's a plausible, I think this idea that, the way that, I mean, one of the most incredible things of the book for me is how the description of the bodies becomes so reportage and so cold. And, you know, I found this incredible trick that the book was playing on me. I like that idea of it playing tricks on us. Like, where I was reading those parts and I was like, oh, hurry up and get to something. And I thought, holy shit.
Yeah.
I'm saying, hurry up and get over all these dead women. Because, you know, and I just think it seems to implicate us in all sorts of ways, the book.
It also, it's in the act of making them visible, they become invisible.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I felt too, you know.
Which is just an amazing thing. To segue again, because that's how I segue. You mentioned being in Central and South America, and this is the thing about, that's one thing as a writer that I really took from this book, is that the balls of it to sort of go all over the world, to be global, you know, and I just think, what is it like having this book in your kind of being and then to be in South America? Like, what do you carry it with you? Does it reinvent the book? Like, this idea that you read the book twice, you know, once here. You know, I was thinking about how today is such a kind of grey Wellington day to be talking about this book, but I wonder, did it affect you reading it in the two different settings, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think when we were in Mexico, I had this notion maybe before I left that I'd try and find some of the places that he talked about in Savage Detectives in Mexico City. When I was in Barcelona, I kind of wanted to tiki tour up to Blanes, you know, because that's where he lived. I think most of the time he spent in Spain. I don't think it really did. I didn't carry it like that, because I carried another book from Peru all the way to London, which was Infinite Jest.
Aha.
God damn you, David Foster. Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, we went to some shanty towns and things like that. We volunteered in Ecuador, and we volunteered in Peru and Argentina, I think. And I think more than anything, that kind of travel will and has informed my own writing.
Yeah.
More than taking something out of here and transplanting or taking it with me as I go. But having said that, you just don't know at what kind of level of sub or level of consciousness that you take the stuff with you. Like, I think writing, you might write something that without knowing it is based or derived from a book that you've read, so I think one of the quirks that I like about his writing in this book is the fact that he might narrate something and then go back on that and ask another question which kind of refutes that thing that he's asked, which I've tried to find my own writing, but I think, you know, it's a mammoth book, and I kind of feel like it is a modern masterpiece.
Yeah,
you know, and I know how that might sound, but I definitely do think that it's born out of its environment.
Yeah,
you know, and it's born out of the kind of political upheaval that happened in the late 60s, early 70s throughout, it continues to go on through Latin America, and also, you know, born out of his sickness and his travel. I mean, I'm just supposing here. I mean, I don't really know. Yeah. Like, other things that I read, you know, like he is the ultimate trickster. Maybe this is the last big joke that he's kind of played on us.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is kind of interesting. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah, I don't even know if this is a valid thing to think about, but I do wonder what it means to be a New Zealander reading Bolaño, if you know what I mean. And I just wonder, out of the cultural context that I'm in, like, obviously books have that power to, you know, like, I mean, because someone said to me once that, actually they didn't say it to me, they said it to a lot of people, it was a lecture, but they sort of said, you can translate language, but you can't translate culture. And I just think, you know, the way that Santa Teresa is sort of laid on top of the Ciudad, you know, like, it's sort of laid on top of that. I just, yeah, and I mean, it's impossible because I don't know what it would be like to be anyone else and read it. But yeah, I don't know, like...
But having said that, he didn't experience that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you, I don't think that, I think some, it's kind of, you take what you want and you leave the rest, or like, you can relate to certain aspects of it. Mm. I mean, the violence in there, you can relate to what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. Yeah. You know, you can... all the political stuff that's happening here, the elections, you know, it's like anything, you interpret it how you want to interpret it, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
That's really interesting, eh? When you were talking about, you're talking about your writing, and you were, did you write while you travel? Do you write while you travel, or do you travel and then write?
I took, I printed off a manuscript that I'd sent to a publisher who said that they were going to publish it, and then they said they weren't, and they wanted me to go back and rewrite some stuff. So I took it and did a little bit of work on that as I travelled, and I guess I carried a journal, but I find it really hard to write when I'm travelling because it kind of takes me away from the action. And if you're traveling, I think maybe this is just me in general, like, I don't want to miss out on anything.
And
so if I'm kind of locked away in my room or at a cafe, I'm not really experiencing stuff. And even, but having said that, you know, like, a lot of travel is actually travel and not doing anything. So I think what happens is that you kind of soak it all up, and then it kind of drip feeds out in certain ways and into your writing. You know, like, I traveled through the Middle East in 2004 and I wrote a couple of travel stories that got published, but that stuff has kind of seeped into the stuff that I'm writing about now. You know, I lived in Japan in Osaka for a year, and that experience has kind of seeped into what I'm also writing about again, you know? So I think it must be different for everyone. I remember reading something about what David Mitchell does when he goes to a new place. He goes to the tallest building in this in the city or point in the building and then writes about what he can see, you know. I probably should do that because I forget a lot. I forget a lot of the scenery and stuff, but then again, maybe the scenery scenes aren't that important. They're maybe just backdrops to the story itself. I don't know.
And sometimes that forgetting can be useful, can't it, because it does give room for imagination,
invention,
which kind of you know, which I think is so, like, that's what I think is so interesting about this, is that, you know, this is not about the real place where these things happen. It's about an imagined place, and yet, you know, it's, if you drove there, you would drive there exactly the same way. And, you know, like, and I think that was another thing that, as a writer, it kind of got me really interested in, was that idea of place, and that place can be hybrid, sort of like imagined and real, sort of thing. And I think, I don't know, like, I'm always interested talking to you about traveling because I haven't traveled, you know, and I just think it's so, I was also thinking, like, when I was doing that last thing, I was using a lot of, like, Google Maps.
But I think that's good, because I think, for me, that's been somewhere, trying to write about somewhere, I try and be too authentic, try to stay too real sometimes to that place, and don't allow to step outside of that and for a little bit of play and invention, you know. I think, like, I think you're right, like, it's good to sometimes get all the details, because sometimes those details kind of can be an obstacle, I think. For me, anyway, like to hold me back from trying to tell a good story, as opposed to, like, it should be authentic and honest, but then maybe staying too true to the surroundings might not be a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Because I think that's what's interesting in here, is that it often gives the, that word authentic, I have such a problematic kind of relationship to it. And I think what's interesting in here is that it gives the effect of authenticity, or it seems to give this kind of language of truth. Yet, like you say, you know, it's tricks. You know, like it's all tricks. And, you know, like, and it's almost like that sort of, and I think, you know, that idea that you can put something real in there and everyone's like, oh, what's real, what's not, you know, like, I think that's one of the things that I love about this book so much.
Because also, like, there are, you know, people have said that he had, you know, as I think publishers and viewers and said he may have had a heroin addiction, but I think that possibly is a fabrication as well, from other things that I read. Some of his friends have said he wasn't even in Chile during the Pinochet coup. So I don't know. I think, is it a good story? If it's a good story, is that all you need to do, or does it need to be a good story and true and authentic? I don't know. But those are probably the things that writers and critics and readers are probably always going to grapple with.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, there is that weird thing. We're like talking about it kind of undoes the experience of reading it, eh? Like it does. You know, like that thing you're saying about how to explain it to people, you know, like I just remember while I was reading it, people would often comment on the size, you know, they'd be like, oh, this is a big book. And, you know, and people would say, what's it about? And I would always say it was about murder and rape, like that.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
that's, yet towards the end, I sort of had to undo, you know, what is this? You know, it seems to be about criticism. It seems to be about university. It seems to be about, you know, like it just seems to be about everything.
Did he have an academic life?
I have no idea. You see, I...
Because I don't... Sorry.
No, you go.
I was going to say, because even though he talks a lot about reading and writing, I don't get the feeling like he's entrenched within academia.
No.
If anything, he just read a lot.
Yeah. I often wonder about... That's what I love about Savage Detectives, the idea that you steal your scholarship, you know, like the idea of stealing the poetry books and stealing away and reading them. And I just think, you know, like to the extent that that's true, I just think what a wonderful, you know, because often your reading is so directed in a university context, isn't it? Like they're like, right, this is what we're reading at the moment. You know, like I was at that symposium we were talking about on Saturday, which was fantastic, but, you know, Adorno seems to be what everyone's talking about at the moment. And, you know, and I just think there is that fantastic freedom that when you're outside of that setting, you know, as I was for, you know, years and years and years and years, you do read odd things, you know, like, you know, my absolute obsession with, you know, Chuck Palahniuk for a while.
And,
you know, like, you do kind of find yourself down different alleyways, eh? Which is kind of interesting. And that, I don't know, you see, this is, I think this is nice as well, because I have all these holes about my knowledge about the book, like, my understanding was that at one stage it wasn't going to be five books. It was going to be, like, there was talk about splitting it up and...
I think there may be some notes in the back of it.
That's right.
That it was, he, to ensure that his publishers made money from his writing after he died, and his, I think she was his ex-wife and children, he wanted them to be sold off, published as a single... like five books, but the publisher went against that because he could see the kind of theme running through a lot of them. Like I said, I don't think he made much money out of his writing until the very end, you know, when he was dying.
And I think, you know, I think as a writer, there's something... I don't know, like that figure of Bolaño does sit, you know, when I am feeling sad about things, you know, when I'm thinking, when I'm sort of feeling sad about my career, whatever the fuck that is, you know, like, I do think, you know, virtually 10 years, all his work in 10 years, all written under a death sentence, you know, and I do, you know, it does kind of get me writing, you know, like that idea that, you know, what really matters is
sell
the work.
Yeah, sell your soul to it almost. Or,
yeah.
But then, like, I like the idea of that.
Yeah.
But the reality of that is that to do that, you probably end up being an absolute prick.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't know. Like, the legend is that he could write for 48 hours straight. But, I mean, I think he probably, I don't know, possibly he manufactured some of that legend too.
Yeah, totally.
But
I'm just looking at that. I'm looking at my small recording device. It's exciting. Yes. yeah, because I think you're dead right. Like, I think that there is that oddness around it, isn't there? Like, yeah, and that odd, you know, like, I often wonder how much of that kind of cult of personality did push it towards, you know, the English translations. Like,
yeah,
it did seem like the English-speaking word was waiting for a figure like this.
Yeah, yeah, because I guess there hadn't been one, for, I guess, since David Foster
Wallace. Yeah, possibly.
Because when was this published in English?
I can't
2008,
remember.
Maybe, yeah?
God, yeah, I mean, it was late. We're flicking through our books. Same edition. You could go to pages. I've got 2009 in paperback in 2008, yeah.
Right, yeah, okay. So then Savage Detectives must have been published like 4 years before that.
Must have been, yeah. It's quite incredible. So to talk a bit about your writing, do you, like, so do you write for 48 hours at a time?
I write when my 2-year-old daughter is asleep between 12 and 2. And then if I've got some freelance work, I'll do that. And then usually in the evenings, or my wife and I, we kind of working part-time each. So I'll take Selva, my daughter, for half of that, and my wife will take her for the other half. And to be honest, I need to, like, destroy my modem to get any, to get any work done these days. It's funny, like, sometimes it's, in journalism they call it the clarity of a deadline, but I think for a writer it's the clarity of no time. So sometimes when I have an hour doesn't seem to do it, but if I have 2 hours, I might do quite a lot of writing. But if I had 4 or 6, I'll just fuck around for like 3 of those. I mean, I don't know. I really think the internet, for me anyway, has severely cut into my writing time.
It's weird, that obsession with it, eh? Like, I was thinking that this morning. Like, I was just, I have got such a ugly relationship with Twitter and Facebook at the moment. Like, I just, I seem to use it as nothing but, you know, someone said to me once while you're on Facebook, and I said, so that I can spy on people, so I can see who's doing better than me, and so I can beat myself up.
Yeah.
You know, that was basically it, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that that's continued, and I just, I feel like it's such a dumb kind of middle class thing to complain about. But the other day I was working out, like, the other day I picked up a book instead of the computer, and I was like, holy shit. You know, like, I'm always like,
how good does it feel to have read a few pages? Like, it feels really good. Yeah.
Which is insane, because I always thought, there's no point in picking up the book if I can't read a chapter. But honestly, like, even the most in-depth, confusing, hard book, if I can read a paragraph, I just feel so good.
Yeah.
And that's what I was thinking about the reading of this book, actually, is, like, the fact that it was in books, I remember thinking to myself, and it's the same way I read Infinite Jest, I just thought, I'll read this page and I might not read another page, you know, and slowly I got through it. But I think that idea of the books, I would say, okay, I'm just going to read this book.
Just finish
this book. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I might just read the next book. And you know, unlike Infinite Jest, I read this in one, like, Infinite Jest I interrupted with the corrections and all sorts of other books. But this book, I just read right the way through.
Yeah.
Can you remember how long it took you? on either of those occasions?
The first time, because I got out of the library, I think I had 6 weeks.
Shit.
So I was reading it at every opportunity.
Yeah.
So I was reading it on the bus. Mm. I think I was actually reading it while walking to work and stuff, which I haven't done in a long time. And I would get out of bed, or I wouldn't go to bed. I'd let my wife go to bed, and then I'd read. I don't know why. It's a big book, but it never felt like hard work.
No.
It didn't. And it was really engrossing. And I have this thing where when I get a book, I always look to see how many pages there are.
I'm the same.
And I never read the back page,
but
I just want to know how many pages there are, so I know where I'm at with it.
Yeah.
And I think I wish I could slow down my process of reading, because I have this thing where there are too many books in the world and I just want to get to the end of them all.
Yeah.
And so I think, especially with a big book like this, the more times I read it, the more I'll get out of it.
Mm.
And the more it'll seep into my being, I don't know. Mm.
Actually, now that I think about it, I think that's why I stopped you on the street. I think you might have been walking and reading.
Oh, really?
That's in my memory now. That's the story now. But I do think that's what it was. I remember seeing you walking and reading and thinking, you know, because that is something that I do with detrimental, very bad results. Bumped into things, falling down hills and stuff like that. And I think that was it. And I think, you know, it's interesting what you say, because it really did. I never felt like I was reading a hard, difficult book, and I don't know how it does that.
But did it feel like you were reading five books?
That's a really good question.
Because it didn't feel like that to me.
Yeah, I don't. And you see, that's the other thing that's interesting, is neither of us are saying that it's difficult, but the other thing about this book is there's no chapters.
Yeah.
Like, we're separated by section breaks, which, you know, just seems incredible too. But yeah, I don't think it ever did feel like five books. Yeah. It felt like there was just this thing that just pulled you through each one, and it held together in kind of this net of sorts. And the other thing that I find odd about it is I can't imagine reading it in any other order.
No, but I read somewhere that you could almost swap the first and last books.
Wow.
I read somewhere.
Oh.
I'm not sure. They kind of...
Oh my God, yes.
What's the word? They go back on each other?
Like yeah.
Possibly. I don't know. I need to read it again to see if... The fact is, sometimes I get the feeling that instead of trying to read all the books in the world, just read the ones that you really, really like.
Mm.
And, well, not really like, we'll get the most out of. And, you know, do what we do now, somehow try and deconstruct and see how it's done.
Mm.
Like, I'd never be able to write a book like that because I don't have the years of, like, reading behind me. But sometimes I think that's what I should do with these books, is read them over and over again to try and figure out the tricks.
Yeah, because you know? I mean, that's one of the things that made me kind of want to do these talks, is that, like, I really think that books are teachers, you know, that idea of reading as a writer and reading to be taught, you know, because obviously this is a dreadful thing to ask, but what sort of things do you think the book has taught you as a writer?
I think one of the biggest things is that there's no shame in trying to, and even if you don't get there, and I'm not even published, but is to go for the big thing, and to even fail miserably at it. He didn't fail, but like I said, he got rejected a lot.
Mm.
And then he wrote this and other things, and I think maybe his writing is a commentary and a backlash at those rejections, you know, and he kind of found his own way. And that's, I think maybe that's how all the great books are written, is that you just think, fuck it, I'm going to do what I want to do, and if it makes me happy or I find a reader or two, then great. But this isn't about fitting into any kind of particular genre or box. I think that's probably the big thing that I got out of it. I think I don't know, it's hard. Maybe also it's okay that I haven't that I'm not as knowledgeable as he is, you know, because like I said, I don't think any of that ultimately the people that he quotes, or this is just my reading of it, or the books that he's read actually mean a whole lot in the overall scheme of things.
Yeah.
Perhaps. I don't know. Yeah. What about you?
Oh God. I don't know. I really liked what you said. I'm going to talk about that first while I'm thinking desperately. No, but I really like, I often think to myself, and this is a horrible thing because I know that his life would have been a lot easier and the people associated would have been a lot easier, but I often wonder what would have happened if that first rejection had been an acceptance.
Mm.
And I also wonder about this idea that, you know, that idea that, I'll talk for myself, you know, like that I do, you know, after that first book was published, I did find myself writing slightly differently, and there was a degree of risk that went after, you know, after those reviews came in and people were saying, you know, this is an awful book, or this is dark, or whatever, you know, like it did alter the way I wrote. And I think there is some kind of freedom that comes, and I think that, yeah, I don't know, it's a stupid thing to think about because you'd never be able to know. Right, what did I learn? Exactly what you're saying. I think it was amazing for me to read a book that kind of went to the Second World War, then went here, then went there, then went there, you know, like it just seemed, and so many you know, characters, and, you know, and it just seemed like, it did seem like the big thing, and that idea of going for the big thing really did. The other thing about it, which I think you and I talked about, was that idea of the kind of the persona narrative, you know, the idea, because there is that theory, isn't there, that the book's been written by
Arturo Bellano.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we talked about that as Spanish being that language where you're able, because the person is implicated in the verb, you are able sometimes to be slightly more corporate or more flexible in where your point of view is coming from.
Yeah, and I wonder what we're losing in translation.
Don't even start. Oh, it makes me sick that, you know, like, it makes me sick that I've only read this in English. Like, I'm sure it's a fantastic translation. And, you know, I have this dream. I read Antwerp this year, which is this tiny little book which seems to bridge his poetry and his prose, as you know, fiction, and it's very small, and I was thinking if I could just read that, if I could just read that in Spanish, I would be happy. Have you attempted to read any of his stuff in Spanish?
No, I wonder if there's like Castilian Spanish, and then I wonder if he wrote in Catalan, but I don't think he would have, because he may have picked it up, but depending on whether he uses a lot of slang in colloquial language, having grown up in Mexico and being Chilean, I remember being in Argentina and we were staying in a bed and breakfast, and there were a Chilean couple there, and we'd kind of prided ourselves on our ability to understand Spanish and speak it and stuff. And these Chileans was just like, I don't know what the hell you're saying, you know? And even the Argentinian hosts were like, we don't understand either. So, but I think on paper, you'd probably find that it would be much easier to read than to speak it, because a lot of the roots, the Latin root of the English words can be found in the Spanish, you know? And you can kind of make it up as you go along. I don't know about you, but if you can read... French seems a lot easier to read than obviously to speak. There's that kind of Latin connection, but there may be stuff that you wouldn't understand because if we use a lot of slang in language or the street or whatever. But that's kind of, I remember saying after reading it the first time, oh, my goal is to read 2666 in Spanish one day. But I mean, you'd probably need to do another 4 or 5 years of Spanish before you even attempt that.
In Spanish class the other day, I tried to call it by its name, and I was like, oh, is it dos mio, you know, or do we just say dos, you know, like, do we just say 2666, or do we say 2666? And I just thought, God, it just, you know, there is the extent to my Spanish, I can't even do the title.
I don't know, I guess... I've never seen it written as 2666, so I suppose it'd be dos, seis.
Because that's the other wonderful thing about, you know, that payoff at the back, the idea of the year 2666 and how the book kind of aims towards that, and just, You know, that again is another thing that I think I've learned from that book, is the fact that it really is, you know, it is okay to aim for the crazy, you know, yep. to have the crazy idea in with the realism, you yep. know, like to have the crazy idea in there.
And I guess it's, in that sense, you know, maybe it's one of these timeless novels.
Yeah.
That, because of that, the ideas within it and the way it's structured and the way it's kind of, its trajectory, maybe it is a book for now and for the future. And it kind of chronicles the past at the same time.
yeah. It just, I mean, I totally agree. Like, I think that was what I found really interesting in there with this stuff about the bureaucrat who's working for the Nazis. And, you know, like, yet another reimagining of the horror of the show, but in a way that is a bureaucratic horror, you know, and that almost seemed more horrifying. And I was thinking, isn't it amazing that a book that was, you know, published in, you know, the 21st century now can still teach us stuff about the horrors of human beings and, you know, and the horror of that event. And I think that it's quite incredible.
But do you get, like, any hope from this book?
I do, and I don't know what that says about me.
Yeah,
I just don't know what that says about me. There's something about the beauty of it, you know, the horrific, the way, I cannot work out what it is that gives me hope about this book, but I found it, I never found it a process, even in those darkest, most violent moments, for some reason, and I don't know if that's me or I don't know. Like, have you got any thoughts on that?
I don't feel like there's any hope for humanity in this book.
No.
But I feel like there's, I just thought of it now, there's kind of hope for the novel.
Yes.
In this book. You know, I don't know how that sounds, but I don't. Maybe 2666 is the end point.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't think there are any, well, the heroes anyway don't survive, but I can't think of anything positive for humanity or the world that comes out of this book, because it's just a chronicle of, you know, the bad shit that we do to each other.
Yeah.
But as a novel, yeah. Like, there's, yeah.
Which is such an odd thought. I don't know what that says about us. Yeah. That we're all for the novel, but fuck humanity. No.
No, I don't think either of us are fuck humanity.
We're
but
not,
like,
saying that at all.
Look at what's happening in the world
right
now, you know. Like, we're, again, at a really, really bad point in history.
Yeah.
I guess there's not, you know, what can writing teach us at these times, you know? Like, I guess we go to, like, things like social media and social networks like Twitter and Facebook are connecting the world, and I guess look at what, how countries and people are saying enough's enough in Gaza. Maybe that's where the written word kind of comes into play as helping humanity.
And there's such a great idea, thinking of the tiniest packages of language, you know, those 140 characters or whatever it is, and then thinking of something this big and thinking that, you know, it is, maybe it's all part of the same machine, which is quite a, I don't know.
And maybe it's all the same, we're getting real, like, metaphysical. Maybe it's all part of the same stuff anyway.
And now someone's phone's ringing.